So, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, you didn't miss too much. It was mainly motivation. So we discussed various compactifications of character varieties, which I should have mentioned yesterday. It originates in the work of Thurston, and for higher rank, it's recent work of Anne Perrot, and of course Morgan and Sharon also. So we discussed these compactifications of the character variety on the one hand, and on the other hand, we had a compactification of the Dirac moduli space. And we saw that understanding how these compactifications are related, it boils down to understanding certain WKB exponents, or at least that's understanding these WKB exponents would be a first step towards understanding how to compactify the Riemann-Hilbert correspondence. So today I want to discuss the very concrete question of computing these numbers, these WKB exponents. Okay, so just let's recall from yesterday that our setup was we're working on a Riemann surface, and we're looking at families of SLRC connections on some rank R bundle. And such a family of connections, which is got by starting with some connection and deforming it by a Higgs field, gives you a family of monodromy representations. And what we're after is to understand the size of that monodromy representation as this parameter h bar goes to 0. Okay. And we saw yesterday that you can let h bar go to 0 in C, but the answer you get depends on which direction you go to 0 in the complex plane. So it's more natural to let h bar be a real parameter, or at least a parameter that's restricted to some sector in the complex plane. Okay. And then we define this WKB exponent, which is given by that expression, which, going back to the previous slide, it's just a way of expressing that you want to say that the transport operator grows like e raised to the WKB exponent over h bar. Now, I sort of gave a heuristic argument based on the WKB approximation that if your path is very small and if it's away from the turning points and all the bad points in your Riemann surface, then this WKB exponent should look like the largest eigenform. So suppose you have a path and you can order your eigenvalues along that path, the eigenforms of your Higgs field, then this WKB exponent should roughly be the eigenform, the integral of the largest eigenform. So you might ask, what about the other eigenforms? Can I produce some exponents which record all of the integrals of all of the different eigenforms? And you can, so we can define a WKB dilation spectrum, which is a set of numbers, alpha 1 through alpha r, which are characterized by the following two properties, that the alpha i's live in the fundamental Weyl chamber. In other words, the alpha i's are a decreasing sequence of numbers. And furthermore, if you sum the first k numbers, then that's just the WKB exponent of the kth exterior power of your connection. Okay. So I'm not saying anything very sophisticated. All I'm saying is if you take a matrix, let's say you take a 2x2 matrix, and you know its largest eigenvalue, but you want to know the other one. If you take its determinant, that will tell you the sum of the eigenvalues. You know the first eigenvalue and you know the sum of the eigenvalues. I mean, it'll give you the product, but we're taking the log of the product. So that's going to give you the sum of eigenvalues. And so if you know both the largest eigenvalue and the sum of the two eigenvalues, then you can recover the list of eigenvalues. So we're just doing that for a higher rank matrix. Okay, so the question is, how do we compute this WKB dilation spectrum? So it's a list of numbers, and I want to compute it. And my approach is going to be to do something which is a time-tested method, which is to just keep reformulating your problem in a tautological way until it's, the obvious answer becomes obvious, right? So first of all, note that I was a little hand wavy in the previous two slides. I said you take the norm of the transport operator, but yesterday I forgot to mention that to define the norm of the transport operator, you need a norm on the Hom space between the fiber at the starting point of the curve and the fiber at the end point of your path. To get such a norm, well, one way to do that would be to fix a Hermitian metric on E. It really won't matter which Hermitian metric you fix, just fix any Hermitian metric. And then you get an operator norm. Sorry? It will change these numbers, the norm of the transport operator, but I claim it will not change the limsup of it will not change the WKB exponents. That's my claim. We'll see. In the end, the answer will depend only on stuff that's auxiliary. It will only depend on the spectral cover. So, so a priori does depend on this choice, but. Okay, so let's just, we have this Hermitian metric on our vector bundle, and I want to just find different ways to think of a Hermitian metric on a vector bundle, right? So if I have this Hermitian metric, one thing I can do with it is, well, I also have a connection. In fact, I have a connection for every value of the parameter h bar. So what I can do is I can fix some base point, and I can transport the Hermitian metric from some other point. So given any other point, I can just transport the Hermitian metric from the other point to the given base point. In other words, for every path in X, which I can also think of as a point in the universal cover of X, I get a metric on the fiber at my fixed base point, right? But the space of metrics is just the symmetric space SLRC mod SUR. So in other words, to give a Hermitian metric on my vector bundle is the same thing as to give an equivariant map from the universal cover to the space of all metrics, which is the space of all metrics on this fixed fiber. So now we'd like to analyze and ask, well, what kind of structures do I have on the space of all metrics? Well, of course, I have the usual Riemannian metric, which comes from the Killing form. But I also have what I'm going to call the Finsler distance between two metrics, which is given by this expression. You look at the unit ball with respect to the first metric, and you take the supremum of the other metric on that. So you have the unit ball with respect to h, and the other guy is elongated in some direction. This is the unit ball for h. This is the unit ball for k. And we're just looking at the direction that's there's some stretch factor in some direction, and that stretch factor, the log of that stretch factor is the norm. Okay. In fact, you can do something more sophisticated. You can find a basis that is simultaneously orthogonal for both the Hermitian metrics, and then you can look at the stretch in each of those with respect to that basis. So let EI be a basis which is orthogonal for both H and K. And you can look at the stretch factor in each of the directions given by that basis. And that gives you a list of numbers. We'll take the logarithms of those numbers, and that defines a vector valued distance. Now, here's the main observation, which is, again, a tautological observation, is that this log of the norm of the transport operator is simply the distance between the lift of the starting point of my curve gamma to the lift of the end point of the curve gamma. Just reformulating, if you go back to the definition of the norm of, maybe I don't really have a definition here. But yeah, so that's essentially a tautological reformulation, but that's the key point. So is that, if there's any questions about it, now would be a good time.
Can you remind what capital H and capital K is?
There are two points in S, in the symmetric space, SLRC mod SUR. Okay, so I'm defining a sort of non-conventional distance, which I'll call vector value distance or refined distance, which takes values not in real numbers, but it takes values in the fundamental Weyl chamber for the group SLRC. In other words, this is a decreasing sequence of real numbers.
With the right invariant metric, you divide it by SUR. You got a metric space, and whenever you have a metric space, you can define a new Finsler metric. Is that what you did? The norm on the right hand side was the norm that you got as a quotient space, right?
This norm?
Yeah, the definition of the Finsler
was
there's a norm on the right hand side.
Is that interesting? the norm would be.
Yeah. What's the norm on the right hand side of the definition? Because that's their.
That's just
that's
the quotient of a particular number. This log is. I have two metrics. I take the unit ball of one metric and I look at the unit ball of the other metric with respect to that one, and I see how much I've elongated my stretched. I don't know if there's some very general framework into which this fits where you can produce Finsler metrics from. H and K are are Hermitian metrics.
Oh, I see.
So there are points in this. Any other questions?
So little h is a...
Is a Hermitian metric on the vector bundle.
Oh, on the bundle, and then
and
h is on x.
And now I'm fixing a fiber. I'm fixing a point in my Riemann surface. And I'm looking at the fiber over that point. And I'm looking at all Hermitian metrics on that fiber. I'm saying that giving this metric on the bundle is the same thing as giving an equivariant map from the universal cover of my original space into the space of metrics on this fiber, just by transporting. Because in the presence of this, all this is happening in the presence of a connection, a family of connections, actually. Right. So we started out with, we have this family of connections, nabla sub h bar, that's sort of the background data. And I'm saying that in the presence of this family of connections, giving this metric is the same thing as giving a family of maps, h sub h bar, for each h bar. Okay, so now, well, what were we after? The WKB exponent was just you multiply this by h bar and then take some limit. Right? So let's do that. Yeah. Sorry? Lambda 1 to lambda r are defined by this.
Are there different lambda?
Okay, so now we can just take the limit or the limb sup, right? So our WKB exponent is given by, this thing is dying, but sorry, that's okay. I don't know, thanks. Oh, it's over there. Okay, maybe later. Not a bad idea. As things get more, so the WKB exponent, nu of gamma, is given by this limb sup as h bar goes to zero of the norm of the transport operator. But I just told you that that's the same thing as the limit. So I'm going to be a little fuzzy for a second, is some kind of limit of h bar times this Finsler distance in the symmetric space. Okay. So now here's my claim that it's a very general construction which says whenever you have a sequence of metric spaces with a metric on each space, you can build a new space, which is some kind of Gromov-Hausdorff limit of that sequence of spaces, such that the distance in that limiting space is exactly the limit of these distances. Okay. I'm going to call that space the cone of the asymptotic cone of the sequence of spaces. In any case, what have we achieved? We have shown that this WKB exponent can be written as a distance in some space. Right? So in the previous slide, I showed you that the norm of the transport operator is the distance in the symmetric space. But now I have a sequence of maps to the symmetric space, h sub h bar, because it depends on the choice of connection, which depends on h bar. And I want to let h bar go to zero. So in the limit when h bar goes to zero, I get a map into some new space, which I'm going to call the asymptotic cone of this sequence of space. Yeah, very good question. So a limb sup is not an actual limit, right? So to make it a limit, well, I'm taking this limit. I'm going to take a limit of spaces at the end of the day. I'm going to say that I have a sequence of symmetric spaces with rescaled metrics, and I want to take their limit. But the limb sup is not the same as the limit. You need to pick out a convergent subsequence that converges to the limb sup. So an ultra filter, this omega is an ultra filter, which is like a probability measure on the natural numbers, which lets you pick out, which gives you, it's just a device that picks out a convergent subsequence for any sequence.
I could write down the formal definition, but I don't think it's awfully illuminating. It's some device that's going to pick out this convergent subset. Different choices of ultrafilter could potentially lead to different limiting spaces, right? I'm taking the limit of these spaces and I could get different answers depending on the choice. And that will be important in a moment. Okay. Does anyone want me to actually define what an ultrafilter is? Just say what it is. I think it would be, okay. So I want to now tell you what this cone actually is. How do you define the cone? So it's not all that scary an object, it's something very concrete. If I'm given a sequence of spaces yn, I really have only one space in this case, y, and I have a sequence of metrics on it. You could do this more generally for a sequence of spaces. So I have a space y, and I have a sequence of metrics, which is hn times the original metric. So you can define a new space in which the points are sequences of points in your original metric space, with the condition that there's some fixed base point in your space with respect to which these points are at a bounded distance. So if you take the distance in the nth space from the base point and take the corresponding sequence of distances you get, that should be bounded. And then you define the distance between two such sequences to simply be the limit of those distances with respect to this ultrafilter. So that's some formal definition of this thing. What does it actually mean to rescale the metric? It means that you're taking your space and you're looking at it. Imagine that you're going further and further away from it and looking at it from infinity. And what you see will be the asymptotic cone of the space. Right? So for example, if you took the lattice Z2 in R2 and you keep rescaling it and look at it from infinity, it's going to the lattice points are going to get denser and denser in R2 until at the end you just see R2. Here's another example. You could take something like, that's something that I wrote there, you could take something like the parabola, and as you look at it from further and further, the vertical arms of the parabola are going to appear closer and closer to the y-axis until in the end you get just the y-axis. If this is my original guy, it's going to become that thing. So that's another example of a cone.
Why parabola is shrinking this way and not like approaching?
Because it goes, it climbs faster than it. It's not linear, right? It climbs. But you're rescaling equally in all directions when you rescale.
Why does this appear in WCP?
Sorry?
Why does this construction appear in WCP? I want a philosophical answer.
Philosophical. I don't know. It pops out of this construction. I mean, I don't know. it's called the cone because, actually, good question. I don't know. I'm not really sure why. I don't. It's a terminological question. I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure what kind of answer you want for have in mind. So maybe we can talk later. Okay. Yeah. So before I go on, let me give you one more example of a cone, which is more interesting, which is if you take, maybe I'll write over here. If you look at hyperbolic N space, with the metric where, so this is, sorry, this is with the metric given by right. So then I claim that the cone of HR is always an R tree. So let me define what an R tree is. An R tree is well, yesterday I drew lots of pictures of trees, but I'd never defined what a tree is. An R tree is a metric space which is uniquely geodesic, which means that any two points are connected by unique geodesic. And zero hyperbolic. So I'll tell you what zero hyperbolic means. So being delta hyperbolic means that if you have a triangle in your space, a geodesic triangle, then if I take any point on one of the sides of my triangle, it's within a distance delta of the other two sides. Okay, so zero hyperbolic means is the limit where all these things become one. So you end up with a tripod. Right? So in any tree, you see that kind of a picture. You can easily see that any tree must be zero hyperbolic. And R tree is a metric space which is uniquely geodesic and zero hyperbolic. So I claim that the cone of the hyperbolic space is always an R tree. And the way to see that is that the space HR is that HR is delta hyperbolic. For delta less than one, for some delta less than or equal to one, you can check that. And then when you take the cone, you're rescaling the metric, so you're sending that making the delta smaller and smaller. So in the limit, you get something that's zero hyperbolic. That's sort of the vague idea behind it, the heuristic idea, and you can make that idea rigorous. Okay. So what's an example of? I claim we've already seen an example of this today. If you look at SL2C mod SU2, this is hyperbolic three space. So one way to show that is to represent SL2C in the Lorentz group of signature 1, 3, and then you can see that if you restrict it to unit vectors, you get you restrict that action to unit vectors, you get this isomorphism. Okay, so we have seen that the distance in the cone of SL2C mod SU2 computes WKB exponents for rank 2 vector bundles. And I've just told you that this cone is actually an R tree. So in other words, I've told you that you can compute the WKB exponents for any rank 2, or rather rank 1. Rank 1 means the vector bundle is of rank 2. For any rank 1 WKB problem in terms of distances in some tree. Yeah.
For that example, is it just like a phrase?
No, in fact, it's a very horrible. I should have said that. It's a fairly horrible space because what you have here is basically what are the lines in the resulting R tree? They correspond to geodesics in H3. But if you sit at some point in H3, there are uncountably many geodesics going out in every direction. So this cone of SL2C mod SU2. Is an R tree with uncountable branching, meaning that at every point there's uncountably many rays going out, and that happens at uncountably many points on your tree. So, it's some pretty horrible space, but it's a tree.
I have a question. So what is the reason that in the case of the Z2,
it's
so you have finitely many geodesics between two points.
Yeah.
Then you take the cone, you are going to infinitely many geodesics. But in the case of the hyperbolic space, you are going from infinitely many geodesics to just one geodesic, which is zero hyperbolic.
Yeah.
Well, why is that? Why is that happening?
I'm not sure. I guess it has to do with it being, you're starting with something negatively curved.
Okay.
I need to think more to give a better answer. So. Okay, so we saw that for SL2C mod SU2, this cone is an R tree. And so it's natural to ask in general, what extra structure does it have, right? If you go to higher rank, what structure does it have? And just as we saw for SL2C, you can ask for higher rank whether you can interpret. For SL2C, I should remark is that for SL2C, the WKB dilation spectrum just consists of one number. Right? The other number is completely determined because the sum of the two numbers is zero. So you can ask whether the entire WKB dilation spectrum has some interpretation in terms of this cone. And finally, you can ask whether this map to the cone that we're studying has any special properties. And that's what I want to answer. And it turns out that the answer, just as we saw for the case of SL2C, where the geodesics and SL2C are what survive in, when you pass through the cone. Everything else collapses onto the geodesics. And a similar feature thing happens in higher rank, where everything collapses onto some flat submanifolds of your symmetric space. Okay, so let's take some general symmetric space of non-compact type. That's some space of non-positive curvature in the sense of Riemannian geometry. It has non-positive sectional curvature. And the typical example I want to keep in mind is this example that we've been talking about, SLR, CMOR, SUR. Everything will generalize to whichever symmetric space you take. So what's the analog of a geodesic in one of these spaces? The analog of a geodesic is a copy of Rn, which is a totally geodesic submanifold, which means the Levi-Civita connection on the ambient submanifold restricts to the Levi-Civita on your submanifold, and the submanifold is flat and diffeomorphic to Rk. And furthermore, I want to look at those guys which are maximal with respect to this property. So of course, my symmetric space will have geodesics in it, but they won't be maximal with respect to the property of being a flat submanifold. In fact, you can determine the dimension of these maximal flat submanifolds in terms of the Lie theory. Namely, if you take a Cartan decomposition, so you can write, for example, you can write SLRC as SUR plus Hermitian matrices. So my P here will be Hermitian guys. Then I can look at maximal abelian subalgebras inside inside P, which will be, for example, it amounts to choosing a basis and then looking at all elements, all diagonal guys. For some choice of basis. And then if I exponentiate that in the Riemannian geometry sense, look at all geodesics generated by that subspace of the tangent space, that's going to produce a maximal flat submanifold inside my symmetric space. Okay. So these maximal flat submanifolds enjoy a very rich geometry in symmetric spaces. So they satisfy analogs of the Cartan Hadamard theorem. So if you have any negatively curved space, then negatively curved for me will mean in the sense of, so a space is cat zero, a metric space is cat zero, which is a non-positive curvature condition. If the following happens, namely, if you look at any triangle in my space, this is in, let's say X is my metric space, this is a triangle in X, then I can construct a comparison triangle inside Euclidean space. Let's call this X prime, Y prime, Z prime, where the distances between X and Y are the same thing. All the distances in this picture are the same as the distances in this picture. And then the condition of being cat zero says that if you look at any point M on one of the edges, then the distance from M to Z should be less than the distance from the corresponding point M prime to Z prime. Ah, sorry. Okay. So what it's saying is that the triangles in my space are somehow thinner than the triangles in Euclidean space. So maybe I should have drawn this a bit more curved like that to emphasize that. Okay. And if my space comes from a Riemannian manifold, then this is essentially saying that the sectional curvatures are non-positive. But I'm going to deal with singular spaces, and this notion of curvature makes sense for singular spaces. Okay, so one of the nice features of cat zero spaces is the Cartan-Hadamard theorem, which tells you that if you have any two points, there's a geodesic connecting those two points. And furthermore, that geodesic is essentially unique if you're simply connecting, yeah, which is part of the definition of CAD theorem. So these properties of symmetric spaces, which are in this theorem, are saying that there are analogs of the Cartan-Hadamard theorem where you replace geodesics by maximal flat submanifolds. So if you have any two points in the symmetric space, there is an apartment, which is one of these maximal flat submanifolds containing both X and Y. And these apartments are essentially unique, meaning that if you have two points contained in two different copies of RK, then the intersection is a convex subset, and there's a map carrying one apartment to the other. This is a version of uniqueness. I mean, I'm suggesting that one should think of this this theorem about symmetric spaces as saying that there is some enriched, there's some sense in which these are CAD zero for a different notion of distance, which I'm not spelled out, but let me put it this way. The symmetric spaces have a distance which is valued not in real numbers, but in this fundamental Weyl chamber. And what I'm suggesting is that if you develop metric space theory for this kind of distance, then the analog of the Cartan-Hadamard theorem will say exactly this. That's a way to think about this theorem. Okay, so now I'm ready to introduce, to tell you what the cone of the symmetric space is going to be. It's going to be something called an R building. And an R building is going to be something which, where I turn this theorem into axioms. So essentially the idea is that we saw in the case of SL2C that the entire, when you take the cone, the entire space collapses onto the geodesics and the geodesics form an R tree. So in this case, in the case of the symmetric space, when you take the cone, the entire space will collapse onto the union of all the apartments, which will form something called an R building. Okay. So in order to tell you what those things are, I first need to say something more about what structure these apartments, these maximal flat submanifolds have. They're not just smooth copies of RK, they have also, they carry an action of the affine Weyl group of the group I'm looking at, so SLRC in this case. Right? So what is the affine Weyl group? It's the usual Weyl group of your group, which is for SLRC, it's the symmetric group on R letters, semi-direct product with some translation subgroup, which is a subgroup of R to the R minus one. Okay. And any of these affine Weyl groups are generated by reflections. So any element, you know that the spherical Weyl group is generated by reflections. So it's easy to see that the affine Weyl group is generated by reflection. So to give you this affine Weyl group, what I need to give you is the set of reflection hyperplanes in the standard apartment, which for us is R to the, for SL, so. For SL2C, the standard apartment is going to be a set of points x1, x2, such that x1 plus x2 is equal to 0. So that's just a copy of the real line. And the action of the group is the group that I wrote down there. So that's this picture I drew here. That's the picture I drew right here, this one. And for SL3C, it's going to be the set of points x1, x2, x3, such that the sum x1 plus x2 plus x3 is 0. That's a canonical way to think about it. And that's, of course, isomorphic to R2. And with respect to that isomorphism, the reflection hyperplanes for the action of the symmetric group on three letters are given by these lines.
Just by what do you mean? S3 crosses the two apartments. So apartment is this plane?
An apartment is, so it depends on, it's going to be, it depends on which group I'm considering. So if I'm looking at SL2C, then I'm looking at apartments. So an apartment is defined as soon as I choose an affine Weyl group. The affine Weyl group for me is coming from the input data of a group. So if I take SL2C, the affine Weyl group is S2 cross some subgroup of the real numbers.
Yes,
it acts on the real line, and it's generated by reflections in a set of points. And the set of points will, of course, depend on what this translation group is. If the translation group was R, then the set of points would just be the whole real line. I can reflect in any point. If it was the rational numbers, then the set of points would be the set of rational numbers, and so on. An apartment for this guy, again, I've drawn the picture for S3 cross Z2, but really, for the applications I'm interested, I'm going to take S3 cross semi-direct product with R2. So these lines will again become dense in the plane. Any question? So each of my maximal flat submanifolds in the symmetric space has this structure. It has an action of the affine Y group. And in the previous theorem, I told you that the intersection is a convex subset. It's in fact a convex subset in the sense that it's bounded by these reflection hyperplanes. It's convex in a stronger sense. So what is a building? A building is, first let's look at what a tree is. A tree is something that's glued out of copies of the real line, right? A tree looks something like that. And each of these is a copy of the real line. And furthermore, if I want to change coordinates from one of the, if I choose a coordinate x on this real line, and I want to change to some other chart, which is say that guy, then the change of coordinates is going to be an element of the affine Y group, which in this case is just reflection. So at the most, so x will go to say minus x plus 7. That's a well-defined change of coordinates, but x going to sine x is not a reasonable change of coordinates. Okay. So I already told you that. An R building is essentially a metric space that's glued out of copies of this apartment, standard apartment, where the change of coordinates comes from elements of the affine Y group. So it's a metric space together with a family of apartments such that any two points are contained in a single apartment. And if a pair of points is contained in the intersection of two different apartments, then there's an isometry which lives in the Y group carrying one apartment to the other. So the case of rank one is, of course, precisely the case of trees. And it's very difficult to draw pictures of higher rank buildings, as you can imagine. But here's a small fragment of what a building for SL3C would look like.
In general, what would be the intersection of two apartments?
It would be some, what I'm going to later call an enclosure. It's going to be something like bounded by reflection hyperplanes. So for SL3C, my reflection hyperplanes are these lines at 60 degrees to each other. And a valid intersection would be, for example, the red triangle would be a valid intersection. The purple sector would be a valid intersection. But so would any union of these triangles. No, it cannot be disjoint because it has to be convex. So if there are two points, convex means that every time I have two points, then the line containing them is there. And here you have to interpret the line containing two points in a very strong sense. It actually means that if I have point A and point B, then I actually have the entire parallelogram that lives between them. So is that definition of a building?
It's contained in a single apartment, I mean, more than at least one single apartment.
Sorry, that's not good. Not a good use of language, I agree. It should have been that there exists an apartment containing any two points. And there will be lots of them.
All the apartments are the same. It's just one type of apartment.
There's only one type of apartment. I fix a choice of a type of apartment. So I fix my affine Y group. That's all I need to fix. And then I can define buildings of that particular type.
And the family is not even countable. It could be uncountable.
Uncountable, yeah. I mean, R buildings are horrendous. I mean, just like this R tree had uncountable branching, they could have lots and lots of. And all the pictures I'm drawing, I'm choosing the wild group to have the translation, the translation part of the wild group, this T guy, I'm choosing it to be discrete, like Z2 or something. In the actual applications, we are going to look at R buildings, and the R, the adjective R, stands for the fact that my translation subgroup could be all of Rn, which means that the reflection hyperplanes are at, you know, through every point there's a reflection hyperplane. And each of those reflection hyperplanes could be a point where the building is branching.
But what you're saying that the context may be different. For granting the point, there may be several apartments containing them.
Yeah, yeah.
But for this picture of trees, it seems to be a unique one.
No, no. So take these two points, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is an apartment containing them. This is an apartment containing them. And that is an apartment containing them. And so is that one. The four apartments containing them. So here's the analog of the theorem that I just told you. I mean, for SL2C, I sort of explicitly told you how you could prove that the cone is an R tree. Turns out the same thing is true for any symmetric space. The more precise version of that statement, which I, for, you know, I don't want to put too many words on the slides, but the more precise version of that statement is that the asymptotic cone of a symmetric space of non-compact type is an affine R building. That's the correct statement. I omitted some adjectives. But we're only talking about affine buildings, and we're only talking about the symmetric space SLRC mode SUR. Okay, so since, now if I'm given any two points in my build in a building, I can situate them in a single apartment, and then I can take the difference of those two points in that apartment, in the sense I really do subtraction in traditional sense. Oh, where's the chalk? So on any apartment, I have a map A cross A to the underlying vector space, which I'll also denote by A, which just takes x, y to x minus y. Right? And since the affine Y group, since my change of coordinates in the building are only allowed to live in the affine Y group, this means that I get a well-defined function on any building which takes values in A modulo the spherical Y group. Because I only mod out by the spherical Y group because the translation part acts in the same way on both sides. That if I translate X and Y, the difference is still the same. So the only thing I have to worry about is the action of the spherical Y group. And so I get a well-defined distance function on any building which takes values in the spherical Y group. So in other words, I have a distance. This is, in the case of SL3C, this looks like, this is a set of x1 through xr with x1 is bigger than x2 and so on. That should remind you of the WKB exponents.
Do you call this up to a cone, this sector, or this value set to boundary and
I guess you should allow one of the boundaries. It should be a fundamental domain for the action of the Y group. So, I mean, you could include a guy here would get identified with the corresponding guy here. Okay, so what I've proven effectively is that this WKB dilation spectrum is a distance, can be interpreted as a distance in a certain metric space where the metric takes values in fundamental Weyl chamber. And that metric space is not arbitrary, it's an R building. It has a very rich structure, very rich geometry coming from the fact that it's a building. So that answers the first question. We asked three questions. One is, what structure does the space cone omega have? And that's the question we've answered now. The other question we wanted to answer is what structure does the map to the cone have? And that's the next question I want to answer. Any questions?
Does the cone depend on the choice of operator?
Yes, it does. So this answer, let's go back to this slide. So this goes back to the question I got in the beginning of the talk, which is that what role does this choice of ultra filter play here? And the precise statement here is that for any given path gamma, I can choose an ultra filter such that the the corresponding asymptotic cone for that ultrafilter will compute the distance. But at the end of the day, we don't expect this WKB exponent to depend on the choice of an ultrafilter. So it will turn out, and that's what I'm going to explain next, that you can actually reduce the size of this cone to something smaller, which doesn't depend on the ultrafilter.
Does the cone depend on the connection you fixed for the transport map?
No, the cone actually depends on just the choice of the ultrafilter and the choice of a dimension R, because you know, I have the symmetric space and then I have the choice. What does depend on the choice of the connection is this family of maps into the cone,
okay.
Right? So I have a map H sub H bar into the symmetric space, and the map to the cone is gotten by taking the limit of those maps.
So that depends on the
Depends on the choice of the connection. And so that was a very good question I got about the ultrafilter, because that's precisely the next problem I want to turn to, is that this cone is some very big tautological construction you can do with some huge metric space, that which depends also on the choice of an ultrafilter, and which for each path, you know, I get a different space in which I can compute this distance. But let's go back to yesterday's discussion. What was WKB telling us? WKB was telling us that if you wanted to understand the asymptotic behavior of some equation like the Schrodinger equation, we should pass in the semi-classical limit that should be governed by the spectral data of that equation, by the spectral curve. So really what we're after is an answer that only depends on the eigenvalues of the Higgs field that I used to deform my connection. So I would like to reduce the size of this building to somehow make it only depend on the spectral data of my Higgs field. So to do that, I want to understand better the relationship between spectral data on the one hand and these maps to buildings on the other hand. So it turns out that there's a construction going in one direction that's completely general and tautological, I mean, also very abstract and simple, which is the following. I mean, so what is the basic idea behind this? Let me describe the idea. So we know that harmonic forms are the same thing, essentially. Real harmonic forms are the same thing as holomorphic forms. If I give you a holomorphic form, you can take its real part, that's going to be a harmonic guy, and you can go back the other way. So if I have a function, now if I have a function f from, how can I produce a harmonic form? I can produce a harmonic form by taking the differential of a harmonic function. So if I'm a harmonic function to the real line, then I can take its differential and this will correspond to some holomorphic one form. So if I want to manufacture holomorphic one forms, I just take differentials of harmonic maps. And locally, every harmonic one form is going to be some differential by Poincaré lemma. But now what I have, if I give myself a spectral cover, what I have is not a single holomorphic one form, but I have a multi-valued holomorphic one form. So I want to do the same thing where I take the differential of, so if I want, let's do the next case, is I have, if lambda 1 through lambda r is a sequence of holomorphic one forms, then if I want to produce it by this method, I can do that. I just look at maps f from, I should have said this is harmonic. I can look at harmonic maps f from x into r to the r. Right? Well, so if I really had a sequence of holomorphic forms, I'd be done. I'd just look at harmonic maps into r to the r. You can do it locally. I mean, that's exactly the topological obstruction. But what I'm going to be given is not really a function. I'm going to be given a one harmonic one form locally.
And then you can do it
A very good question. Sorry, I understand your question. The thing is that if you go back to the beginning, our maps to the symmetric space are defined on the universal cover. So I'm always going to be working on the universal cover. So that's, it's simply connected. So if I give myself a spectral cover, what I have is not a sequence of holomorphic one-forms, but I have a list of holomorphic one-forms. It's only well-defined up to permutation. But the action of permutation on a list is exactly the action of the wild group, should remind you of the action of the wild group. In other words, if I act here by the wild group, that exactly corresponds to permuting this list. This is some schematic picture, right? So you might think that in order to produce a set of harmonic one-forms instead of a sequence of harmonic one-forms, you should look at maps into some space where the coordinates on this space R to the R are only well-defined up to permutation. But I just told you about such spaces, namely buildings, right? So that's what this slide is about. If I'm given a building, then on the building, the symmetric polynomials applied to the standard one-forms dx1 through dxr on a given apartment are well-defined globally, because if I change coordinates, it leaves the symmetric polynomial invariant. So I can pull back the symmetric polynomials on the dx1 through dxr from my, if I'm given a harmonic map to a building, I can pull these back to my Riemann surface to produce a sequence of holomorphic forms, phi 2 to phi r, which live in the direct sum of these cohomology groups. But that's exactly the datum of a point in the Hitchin base, which is a spectral cover. So the upshot is that if I'm given a harmonic map to a building, its differential, or the pullback of the standard forms from the building, is exactly a spectral cover. So the slogan is the differential of a harmonic map to a building is a spectral cover. Is that clear? It's a good time for questions. Yeah. Yeah. Curly B will always stand for a building from now on.
And X is a universal cover of the curve.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. From now on, let's say X is always simply connected, because in the beginning I was writing tilde X, but let's say it's either our curve is simply connected or we pass to the universal cover and everything is phi 1 equivariant.
So when it's going back from the curve to the building, does it go,
one apartment?
No, that's precisely the thing. It could go to uncountably many apartments. It could keep moving. I mean, in principle, it doesn't have to. In fact, all the interesting phenomena happen because the whole WKB theory, according to what I'm going to tell you next, happens because you can move from one apartment to other apartments.
So when X can be compact, right?
X can be compact, yeah, but universal cover of X will be non-compact. So, I mean, here I'm working with equivariant harmonic maps. I'm being a little imprecise because all the details are annoying. But I'm really working on the universal cover, and these maps are equivariant harmonic maps from the universal cover of X. For the action of pi 1 on the universal cover and for some action of pi 1 on this building. So yesterday I told you that the Betti moduli space can be compactified by actions of pi 1 on buildings. This is. Any other questions?
There's just some basic thing that I don't understand, which is, on your building is not a smooth object. These forms are not smooth. It's kind of real, not holomorphic.
Yeah.
And the harmonic map is not smooth.
Yeah.
And yet you're saying that by simply pulling back these canonical forms, you're going to get a smooth spectral curve in the potential.
Yeah, it's a very good question. There is some analysis involved there, which is that, well, the first claim is that if your map is harmonic in the sense, so I didn't, you caught me on a very good point, which is that I've been talking about harmonic maps into singular spaces without ever saying what I mean. So we know what harmonic maps between smooth spaces are, but there is a way to define, so Gromov and Schoen defined the notion of a harmonic map to a singular space. It turns out you can, to define harmonicity, you need to define what the energy of a map is. Right? If you have a map f from x to y, you need to define this integral df squared over x. This is the energy of some map. Right? And then harmonic maps are ones which minimize the energy. Now it turns out to define this quantity, you can do it if you reformulate the problem carefully, you can define this energy without using the smooth structure here, but just the metric here. And then you can talk about harmonic maps. And it also turns out that if you have one of these harmonic maps, then if H from X to some singular space B is harmonic, then away from some small set, so X is going to be a Riemann surface, smooth space. But B is going to be some singular guy. Then away from a small set, okay, small for us is actually going to turn out to be exactly the ramification points of the spectral cover later on. But for now, let me just say small without being precise. You have a picture like this. For any point x in x, there's an open set u, such that you actually map that open set into a single apartment sitting in B. And then being harmonic just means that each of these maps is harmonic on the small open set. And this is really a map between smooth spaces. So then you're left with the problem of, you know, so you've pulled back these forms to the complement of the small set, and you have to ask whether you can extend it over that small set. But that is possible because of the usual like Hartogs type thing. I mean, you're working with some holomorphic stuff, so you can extend it. There's some analysis there, which I don't want to get into. It's true. Yes, buildings are simply connected.
So this is it more so that if you take the Stokes graph,
yeah,
you take the Stokes region, you glue them together, that's some sort of thing you cover.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing you're doing, you're right, you're absolutely right. I mean, that is sort of the intuition behind this, but it turns out to be like that, you know, just doing that doesn't always give the right answer. You need to sort of do something more, which I'll try to say. But that's that's one difficulty. But even in the simplest examples, there are other like considerations. I mean, the axioms of a building are quite rigid. So to say that you get a building after doing the process you described, you need to argue that it's a building, and it's not. It's usually very hard to prove that something is a building. In that way, that's the problem. Did that answer your question? Okay, so we see that the differential of a map to a building is a spectral cover, and what we're going to do is to try to reverse this construction, right? So we can ask if I'm given a harmonic map to a build, if I'm given a spectral cover, can I produce a harmonic map to a building such that the differential of that map is my spectral cover? And this is where I think this is somehow the key idea, that there's a canonical potential choice for such a guy. Namely, look at the category of all such maps, look at all possible harmonic maps from X to some building, and ask for the initial object in that category. Okay, so I think this is quite this would be like the main novel element in some sense, because it's bringing to bear some universal property and categorical thinking to this question, some question about differential equations. So I think this is really a key idea. The question we're going to ask is, we're going to define the following things. We're going to say a harmonic map to a building is a harmonic phi map if the differential of that harmonic map is my given spectral cover, phi. And we're going to say that it's a universal harmonic phi map if, given any other harmonic phi map, the map factors through my harmonic phi map. And I'm putting the uni in brackets because usually this factorization, you can't expect the universal guy to exist. It will turn out soon. So all you can expect is to construct some guy which is versal, meaning that there's always a factorization, but it's not necessarily unique. Okay. So I already gave you some examples of universal buildings yesterday. Namely, in the SL2 case, we have these pictures that I drew yesterday. Let me draw it again. So we have some foliation. My spectral curve defines a foliation. And I can project to the leaf space of the foliation. Okay. And my claim is that this guy, so this is real part of square root of phi equal to 0, this foliation. And the claim is that this guy is the pictures I can draw are finite trees, but in real life, the leaf space of a quadratic differential will be an R tree. It needn't be a finite tree like this. Just the finite tree. Yeah. So in other words, to compute the I haven't got there yet. So maybe, yeah. So it's just this finite tree, and furthermore, observe that this universal building reconstructs my Stokes graph for me. Namely, the Stokes graph is just the inverse image of these two. It should have drawn it a different color. The Stokes graph is exactly the inverse image of the two singular points of my building. So this is the picture we want to generalize. We want to understand what is the generalization of, so this universal building thing which I just defined, is just a generalization of the leaf space of the foliation of a quadratic differential. It's a very classical object. And we'd like to generalize this picture and say that the higher rank analogs of Stokes graphs are exactly inverse images of the singular loci of the corresponding universal buildings. Okay. Well, but before we move on to higher rank, what can I do with knowing this thing? Well, I just computed all the WKB exponents of rank 2 connections for you in terms of some thing that doesn't depend on the ultrafilter. So that answers the question about the ultrafilter in this case. Namely, I have this map from x tilde to the cone omega of SL2C mod SU2. But this guy is going to factor through this guy H. Well, it turns out this is going to be a harmonic phi map. And why this is a harmonic phi map is what I call the local WKB approximation, which says that for a very short path, the naive idea that the largest eigenvalue gives you the WKB exponent is correct. Okay. And now this guy will factor through this X mod F. Now I'm working on the universal cover, everything is pi 1 equivariant. And if I want to compute the distance in the cone, which gives me my WKB exponent, if I knew that this map is an isometry, I'd be done. Because I can just compute the distance in the leaf space of the foliation. So the only question is whether or not this map is an isometry. So it turns out that that map is always an isometry, except when there are sidereal connections. And you can see that geometrically quite easily, because yesterday I told you that when there are sidereal connections, that's exactly the place where, maybe I should go to that board. So sidereal connections appear exactly when the tree becomes degenerate. the tree looks like that, right? My leaf space, my foliation look like that. And this was my leaf space. And now if I give myself some map to a tree, to some other tree like the cone, I can ask myself whether there is a unique isometric factorization here. But I claim there isn't, precisely when the tree becomes four-valent like this, because you could do the following thing. Let's label this somehow A, B, C, D. Let's label this tree A prime, B prime, C prime, D prime. Then I could, I think I need the colored chalk. I could map the first tree to the second tree by sending the vertical line isometrically to the vertical line. But on this segment here, I can, oh, sorry, this was not the tree I wanted to draw. Apologize. The tree I want here is something that has a little guy jutting out here. Okay, so this guy is C prime D prime. So I map the vertical line CD to the line C prime D prime, but I map this small segment here to, by folding it, by identifying this point with this point, I can fold it along a segment like that. Right? So you can see that as soon as you have a four-valent vertex like this, you introduce the possibility of mapping this tree into other trees non-isometrically, where you have some folding phenomenon happening. So this is like a... Are you, can you see it from where you are?
Is there an intersection between C between the vertical and
horizontal? Oh, no, this guy is going like over. They cannot be intersection, otherwise it would be non-simply connected. But
and where does the AB line get mapped?
To the A prime B prime line. But it goes like when I go from A to B, I go like that.
Like this map is allowed because like when you can also fold some edges and
tail, you know, no, I think if you have trivalent vertices, you cannot fold it locally in your, not be able to, and preserve the harmonic, you know, harmonicity condition. But I'm just a bit confused. Maybe I didn't draw it right. Yeah, I think I didn't draw it right. I'm a bit confused now. I think maybe, maybe the vertical, yeah. Okay, let me write this. I think it should be this guy. Sorry, I think the vertical segment is the blue guy. So then we want, so O goes to O prime and so on. And on this stretch, I go back and forth along this guy. Does that make sense? Where?
The line AB, the closure of the line AB does contain point O, but on the image.
Maybe it's easier to understand. Oh, wait, maybe I draw it wrong somewhere. You can fold. Ah, right here. Right? Yeah. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I think now it's okay. You send O to O prime.
I can see that this map is not injected in the sort of time, but I don't see why you cannot do another.
Yeah, so you can, so if you have, I don't know if I want to explain the proof now. Maybe we can discuss it. Yeah, exactly. I leave it as an exercise. It's a bit, yeah, it's not for, it'll take a bit of time to explain. I just wanted to show that this feature, that the BPS, I mean, you can see that you can fold, in terms of the foliation, you can see that you can fold when you map to a tree. So the reason, the real reason is that you should also take into account the harmonic map, right? You want to look at, you want to say that this guy is universal for all harmonic maps from this Riemann surface into trees, not any arbitrary map of trees. So if I have the point is that exactly when a BPS state appears, I can have a harmonic map to a guy like this, because I can take this BPS segment, this saddle connection, and I can fold back along it. So I can fold this entire picture back onto itself, identifying, say, this point with this point, or identifying this point with this point, and so on. But that's not possible if you have like a generic situation like that. I mean, this is not a proof, but this is just a picture, pictorial.
What allows you to fold things at all? I mean, it's just basically like an arbitrary operation.
So I claim that it's the appearance of this BPS, of this saddle connection.
Yeah, but folding is like an arbitrary thing to the
fold. But you want it to be a harmonic map, right? You want a harmonic map whose differential is exactly your quadratic differential, which folds part of your Riemann surface. Harmonic map to some tree, which will fold. And I'm claiming that if you, that's not something that I can prove like just like that, but it's a. A harmonic map can in principle fold, right? The only condition is that its differential should be this harmonic form, which is the real part of this guy. So what is the universal property of this of the leaf space of the foliation? It says, look at all harmonic maps from X into some building, which for us is a tree. But look at all harmonic phi maps, so harmonic maps whose derivative is my given quadratic differential. That's not very arbitrary, right? It's very rigid condition. It means in particular that locally away from turning points, my map must be given, if I have this local picture, this is my building, then locally my map is given by h restricted to u is just the integral of the real part of the square root. That's quite rigid, I think. So it's determined by the geometry of the foliation. And I'm claiming this can be turned into a proof that actually it only appears when saddle connect. This folding can only happen in this way when saddle connections appear. So when there are no saddle connections, that means that the tree actually computes all the WKB exponents, the distance in the tree. Okay, so we moving on to higher rank in the last 10 minutes, what are we trying to do? I just told you that the universal building for rank one is just the leaf space of the foliation. So what's the analog of the foliation in higher rank? I claim in higher rank, instead of having one foliation, you have a whole bunch of foliations. Namely, I'll show you that on the next slide, which are given by the differences of the eigenvalues, the eigenforms of my Higgs field. Okay. And observe also that I told you that the WKB exponent can be computed by the distance in the tree. But what does that mean? That means if I take a point P and a point Q, then to compute the distance in the tree, what am I doing? I'm taking a path from P to Q gamma, and I'm calculating the transverse measure along that path. That gives me the distance, say, going from here to here, right? But I could as well have gone around the singularity. It only depends on the homotopy class of the path. So I could as well have gone around the singularity, which would then correspond in this picture to going along this edge up to here, and at some point turning back and going up. So obviously, if I integrate the real part of the square root of phi along this path, that gives me the correct answer, which is the distance going from here to here. But if I integrate the real part of the square root of phi along this guy, then I'm going to get the wrong answer because I'm calculating the distance going from here to here plus the distance of going back up. And what's happening is that at some point, my path is becoming transverse, non-transverse to the foliation. So the positive square root of phi and the negative square root of phi are switching signs at that point, switching roles. So it's not valid to take a path that is not transverse to the foliation. So what I just told you says that if I take two points P and Q and I want to compute the WKB exponent, all I have to do is choose a non-transversal path between them, which always exists, it turns out, and just integrate the real part of the square root of phi. That's what I'm doing. That was the original WKB approximation. So in this higher case, we have to ask ourselves to understand this universal building. We would expect that there should be some analog of the notion of a path transverse to the foliation, and that will be exactly what I call a non-critical path, which will be a path that is everywhere, is nowhere tangent to any of these foliations. Okay. So what are these foliations? I'll define that later. I'm checking on the next slide, actually. Yeah, the foliations are these foliations. I may have mentioned them yesterday. Are the real parts of lambda I minus lambda j are equal to 0, where lambda I and lambda j are the eigenforms of my Higgs field. Okay. So let's define a path to be non-critical if along that path I can order the eigenvalues of the eigenforms in decreasing order of size, where the size means the size of the real part. Then we prove an analog of the local WKB approximation, which says that if you have a non-critical path, then the WKB exponent is simply computed by integrating the real parts of these eigenforms. Okay. So you can use this to argue that the map to the cone is actually a harmonic map with differential, the given spectral cover. Because we know on the one hand that this expression nu of gamma computes has differential lambda 1 through lambda r, and on the other hand, we know that it's the map to the cone computes the WKB exponent. So the map to cone omega is a harmonic phi map, and so every time I can construct a versal building, it's gone a bit high. Every time I have a versal building, then I have a factorization of the map to the cone, like that. This is my map to the cone, and it factors to this universal map. And so suppose I could prove somehow that on the image of X, this map is an isometry, then I would have in fact proven that the WKB exponents are independent of the ultrafilter, because this gadget here doesn't depend on the ultrafilter. It only depends on the spectral cover. So that's the idea behind this universal building. Okay. Yeah. So there's a higher analog of these Stokes graphs for spectral curves of higher rank, which are called spectral networks and were introduced by Gaia, Tomo, and Naitsky. I mean, and they were also studied under different names by various people in differential equations, going back to Burke, Nevins, and Roberts in 1983. But Gaia, Tomo, and Naitsky have sort of studied it from a different perspective. So in the rank 2 case, the spectral networks are exactly the Stokes graphs. So they're exactly the singular leaves of the foliation that I drew, the orange lines. And in higher rank, there's a prescription for constructing these things, which is the following. You start at a branch point of type, so you label your sheets by, let's say, 1, 2, 3, and so on. You start at a branch point where the sheets 2 and 3 meet, and you draw the three lines, foliation lines, for the foliation, the real part of lambda 2 minus lambda 3 is 0, and you will get a picture that locally looks like exactly like the local picture for a quadratic differential. Then you go to some other branch point and do the same thing. This is now a branch point of type 1, 2. And again, you get three lines that emanate from that point, which are the trajectories of the foliation, real part of lambda 1 minus lambda 2 is 0. But now here's where the new phenomenon occurs. these Stokes lines carry special labels, right? So this guy carries the label 1, 2, this guy carries the label 2, 3, and when they collide, the rule is that you should draw a new Stoke, a new line, which is the foliation line for you, this is 1, 3 and this is 2, 3, then you eliminate the 3 and draw a foliation line of type 1, 2. Okay, that's some construction. I don't have time to explain it, but that construction actually has a very nice category theoretical interpretation where these 1, 2, 2, 3 and 1, 3 are actually objects in some Foucaille category. And the fact that you have, at this point, you have this configuration of where this is 1, 3, 2, 3 and you delete the 3 to get the 1, 2 is exactly saying that there's an exact triangle over this vertex that remembers how those 3 objects on the edges are related. So there's some nice conceptual explanation for why you would introduce these things. Yeah.
And when 1, 2, and 3 collide,
then they don't produce anything, because in the category theoretical interpretation, there is no extension between the objects 1, 2 and 7, 8, let's say. So there's some conceptual reason for doing this. And the main, yeah, so these spectral networks, as you would expect, play a role in analyzing the WKB exponents. And Gyoto Moronetsky gave a prescription for calculating WKB exponents when, in the situation when the local WKB approximation that I described here, this theorem does not apply. Namely, if I have a very long path, if I have 2 points that are very far away from each other on the Riemann surface, there's no reason to expect that they can be connected by a non-critical path. So then you have to modify your answer that you get from the usual WKB by some detours which are determined by the spectral network. Okay? But I'm not going to get into explaining how that works. One of the reasons for doing this approach with buildings is to give a different perspective on why these detours appear. And to see how spectral networks appear out of this theory of buildings. So what we did is we went back to a very classical example which started off this whole theory of spectral networks in some sense, or Stokes geometries, which was in a work of Burke, Nevins, and Roberts. They analyzed this particular differential equation, which I've written up there, whose spectral curve is given by that equation there. So this is an SL3C example, a rank 3 vector bundle with connection. And the spectral network is drawn here. So this is a picture of the spectral network. And that's a picture of the real picture of the spectral curve. So you can see in this picture that there are 2 branch points. The branch points are these 2 points. And there are 2 points where spectral network lines collide. I call those collision points. So there's a collision point here and a collision point here. Okay. And what they did is that they observed that if you apply the naive WKB to, say, calculate the transport from going from here to here, from a point in that region to a point in this region, you would not get the right answer. And they also gave a sort of ad hoc way to modify that answer by taking into account this new Stokes line, which is exactly what Gyoto Moronetsky also tell us to take into account. So we decided to analyze this example using our theory of, using this notion of a universal building. And what we did succeed in doing is constructing a versal building in this case and showing that it computes the WKB exponents. So there's our theorem. It says that there does exist a versal harmonic phi map for this particular spectral cover, and that for any WKB problem, not just the one that Burke, Nevins, and Roberts considered, but for any WKB problem with the given spectral cover, the map to this versal building computes the WKB exponents. And furthermore, we find a sort of explanation for the appearance of these spectral networks in terms of the building, in that the singular locus of the inverse image under the map to the building of the singular locus of the building is exactly the support of the spectral network. Okay, I'm lying a little bit there, because what we get is not just the spectral network I've drawn here, but we also get the backward lines at each collision point. But that's something that should be investigated if we don't understand why. Yeah, support meaning forgetting the decoration. I mean, each edge of the spectral network is decorated by some labels, right? The ij. Yeah, you don't see those labels, but you see the. Okay, so I'm running out of time. So let me just finish with this conjecture. So we have a general procedure for producing this Wurzel building in for any SL3C spectral cover. And we conjecture that the Wurzel building always exists, provided there are no BPS states. And that's exactly what happens also in the rank, the case of SL2C. You see that when a saddle connection appears, you don't have the Wurzel building anymore. So let me show you some pictures of how that, let's skip some slides. Yeah. So the basis of this construction is the following two observations. That if you look at the harmonic map to the building in the Burke Nevins Roberts example, it always folds the Riemann surface along some curves called caustic curves. So what are caustic curves? Let me just go back to this picture. If you look at these two branch points, there's a line connecting them along which all the three foliation lines are tangent. Okay, so that's what I'm going to call a caustic. A caustic is a locus along which all the foliation lines are tangent to each other. And it turns out that any harmonic phi map to a building must fold your building along a caustic curve. And we see that happening in the BNR example. Right? And you can have more complicated situations where you have not just one caustic, but two caustics intersecting, in which case you'll have some complicated folding phenomenon like that. Okay, I'll skip this stuff. I'm really out of time, so okay. So here are some pictures of how we propose to construct the building in general. The general procedure is to start with your Riemann surface, and you get a singular flat metric on the complement of the caustics, on the complement of the turning points on the caustics, by just mapping into, by using the map, Z goes to the integral of the real parts of these forms. You get local charts on your Riemann surface, which defines a flat structure on your Riemann surface, away from the turning points. So this is what we call our initial construction. And then we have an initial relation on this initial construction, which tells you that if you're near the caustic, you should fold along the caustic. So you should start identifying points that are very close to the caustic. So in this picture, this is a picture of the BNR example again. And you have this yellow line, which is the caustic. And you start folding along the caustic. But what happens when you fold along the caustic is that you get some new construction, which is not positively curved anymore. It has some points which have which is not negatively curved anymore. It has points of positive curvature. But we know that a building has to have non-positive curvature. So the basic idea of this approach is to iteratively kill those points of non-positive curvature by flattening out the Riemann surface at that point. So you iteratively flatten out until in the end you end up with a guy which is where you have sort of collapsed two parts of your initial, you have stuck together two parts of your initial construction. And that guy will have non-positive curvature and will actually be a pre-building if our whole construction works. But I'm sorry for going so fast in the last 5 minutes. I'm out of time, but you can ask me how this works if you want later. And yeah, let's stop there. Thanks.
So in the BNR example, this central yellow region,
yeah,
it's saying that near the vertical line, it's folded.
Near the horizontal line. So
the horizontal line, near the horizontal line is folded.
Yeah. Here's a picture. This is the horizontal, this picture is not, this is the horizontal line, which is getting folded.
That's the caustic line.
And that becomes this region which gets folded over.
Okay, so what is the curve in that diamond where it's no longer folded? There's a curve where it stops being folded.
It's exactly the spectral network. So it stops getting folded when these two points get identified, the collision point above and the collision point below.
So the entire diamond is folded.
Exactly. And you also see that the folding procedure exactly stops when you hit the spectral network. So it suggests that there's a very close relation between our process of constructing the building, and it should exactly stop, all these folding processes should stop precisely when you hit the spectral network.
In the middle of rectangular, there is one partition.
The dot is just because of some computer problems. No. It's not for us, but I heard that it should be some virtual turning point, which is important. I don't know.
If there are no more questions, let's then run up for the great talks.